Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and every time I see a tree growing out of a rock or even weeds popping up through the asphalt in a parking lot, I marvel at the resilience and ingenuity of plant life. The many ways that plants can be propagated is also a beautiful example of that resilience, and of course, it's one that can be harnessed by humans. This hour, we are going to start with a conversation about plant propagation. Then later in the hour, you can join the conversation with your questions about the plants and trees in your life. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me today, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Grant Thompson is also with us today, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Grant.
Hello, good morning.
Welcome to the show. And we're going to talk about plant propagation. And I would like to start with just a moment of kind of recognizing how cool it is that you can do this in so many different ways. I mean, Grant, it really is a marvel, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Certainly plants grow very well from seed, and that's maybe one way that folks are most familiar with plant propagation, but there's a whole slew of methods that we can use to propagate plants vegetatively that are just simply mind-blowing.
Well, let's start with one that has always struck me as awesome and a little bit weird, and that's just taking a cutting from a plant. Tell me how you do that and how it works.
Sure. Usually when we take cuttings, we're taking cuttings from some above ground portion of the plant. Usually this includes a stem, possibly a bud at the base of a leaf. So for example, you might take a herbaceous cutting of a houseplant. You'll take a 3 to 5 inch piece, cut it off, strip some of the bottom leaves off it, maybe use a little bit of rooting hormone, and then as long as we can manage the water and the humidity, roots will begin to grow and we have a whole new plant.
And sometimes you don't even need to use any rooting hormone. You can just pop it in water, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Some plants have preformed root initials. You may be familiar with pothos. It's kind of a trailing houseplant. A little bit of water, and that one's pretty happy.
Well, my grandma used to carry scissors in her purse because anytime that we would go to a restaurant or a store where they had a lot of plants that she thought were beautiful, she would just not very discreetly go up and take some cuttings and then take them home and propagate those. It was pretty embarrassing. But I still have a philodendron that was started from one of those cuttings long, long ago. So how do you know if, let's say, you look at your house plants and you'd like to have more of them or create one to give to a friend or a family member? How do you know if that plant can be propagated through cuttings?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, certainly I would say there's no harm in trying. You know, worst case, if your plant needs a little haircut anyway, you can try to propagate and root what you remove and see if it works. Certainly there are tons of resources on the internet. Any land-grant university should have an extension office with some good details about that. But generally speaking, anytime you see kind of small bumps on the stem, you may see this, say, for example, with tomatoes in the summer, you can see small bumps down at the base. I already mentioned pothos. You also have spider plant. These all have those preformed root initials, and those ones make excellent cuttings because they're all ready to go.
You mentioned root hormone before. What is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so plants naturally produce many different hormones, just like people, and some of those, auxins in particular, stimulate rooting. And you can purchase at a local garden center or off the internet rooting hormone, and those will come in different concentrations. So the really easy to root stuff needs a lower concentration, harder to root things need a bit more help, and it just helps the plant create faster roots, stronger roots, and higher quality roots.
On average, how long would you say that process takes to take something from cutting to something that you can actually plant?
Sure. Herbaceous cuttings, this can be really quick in the matter of, you know, a few weeks to a month. If we're talking about a hardwood plant like a deciduous tree or an evergreen, that can actually take many months, and in fact, over a winter even.
You mentioned the online information. Is that maybe a plan if you have something that you'd like to propagate? You know, identify it and then and then put it into your search engine and look for that information to see how to do it best.
Yeah, that would be a good way of going about it. As I tell some of my students in my plant propagation class, you know, it's kind of like a cooking show. I can share lots of different techniques with you, but, you know, when you have the actual plant you want to do, you kind of want to follow a recipe.
And then how do you know a plant is ready to actually put in soil?
Yeah. Usually what we're looking at is we want to make sure we have a good root system on it. When we take a cutting off a plant, it no longer has roots. So it's really prone to drying out. So usually when we're doing cutting propagation, one of the big things we need to do is manage water and manage humidity. And so we might put it in a well-draining but good media, something like sand would do well for this. And you may need some sort of a humidity dome. That could be a plastic wrap. That could be a bottle. That could be something, you know, as special as a terrarium. But in any case, we're trying to keep the humidity up so that the plant doesn't dry out before it has new roots to replenish its water. So when you have a good root system, that's a good indication that that cutting is ready to be planted.
And then when you plant it, do you have to do anything special to make sure that the stem is strong enough or that it has enough support?
Yeah, sometimes a little extra help. If, say, you have a particularly hot window or you're looking to move something outside, you may need to do that gradually or do it in stages, just the same way that you might harden off a tender plant at the beginning of the year.
Let's talk about layering. That's another technique you can use to propagate plants. What is that?
Absolutely. So layering in some ways is kind of the opposite of a cutting. So in a cutting, we take a stem and we grow new roots on it. In layering, we're trying to grow roots on a new stem before we cut it off of the plant. So it still has the support of the parent plant, the water, nutrients, etc. And in some ways, it's a less stressful way of propagating.
And what kinds of plants does that work well with?
Certainly. That works well with things, houseplants, for example, pothos or Tradescantia, sometimes known as spiderwort, any of these trailing type plants. You can bury a portion of the stem. Sometimes you give it a little sharp bend up just to wound the stem a little bit, and that is going to cause new roots to form in that area once we bury it.
Well, that's so amazing to think that you want to damage the plant a little bit to get it to grow better. But right. It's responding to that stress and it's trying to stay alive, right?
Exactly. The same way that maybe our immune response kicks in when we face a little bit of a challenge, that wound causes a response in the plant to do things like create new roots because it senses that it's been damaged and needs to grow a little bit better.
Well, we've focused largely on houseplants, although you did mention that you can use cuttings with trees and shrubs. Shrubs can also be propagated using this layering technique, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've propagated hydrangea many times this way. You can kind of bend a stem down to the ground, dig a little hole and kind of pin it down that you could use a rock, a stick, or even a piece of wire and bury it. And later in the season, maybe when you're doing your fall cleanup, you can come along and cut the stem that goes back to the parent plant and the now what we would call a daughter plant is rooted and ready to be moved.
So before we move on from talking about propagation, Aaron, I would love to just get a sort of a thumbnail sketch of how common grafting is in the plants that we buy at nurseries and things like that. And we have done shows in the past on grafting techniques. I know you can learn to do it yourself. Most home gardeners don't and maybe don't even want to. But it's also just one of those really remarkable ways that we can manipulate plant life and propagate it. So tell me how common grafting is.
You know, grafting So this is where we're taking two different plant parts, putting them together in such a way that they grow together. And the top part and the bottom part remain genetically separate from each other, but they function as one plant. And the two pieces interact with each other, and often you can use grafting to create unusual forms or to speed up the propagation process. And in particular, in a lot of our woody plants, things like fruit trees and shade trees, a lot of these plants are propagated, and you can see are propagated through grafts, and you can see if they've been grafted, because the spot where we put those two pieces together forms a big kind of knob, that's the spot where those two pieces, where the cambial layers and xylem and phloem and all those things that move water and nutrients through the plants, that's where they've connected to each other. And as an example, pretty much any apple tree that you will ever come across that was purchased from a nursery is going to be grafted. And just about any fruit tree that you'll find in an orchard is grafted. And you'll find that funny little knob usually near the base of the plant.
Well, and this is essential to fruit production, because if you wanted to start a fruit tree from a seed, then it wouldn't produce the same kind of fruit as the one that you picked that apple from necessarily, right? I mean, we wouldn't have the apple industry without this ability to graft.
Yeah. You know, apples are a great example of this. When you plant the seed from an apple, what grows from it is similar, but not exactly the same. If you planted a seed from a Gala or a Granny Smith apple, you would get something that is similar to that apple, but not tasting exactly the same. And the goal is to have the same apple. And one of the ways we can do that is by taking a bud. Usually it's a bud. Sometimes it's a piece of stem, grafting it to a piece of rooted rootstock, and then growing the plant out that way. And one of the great benefits to this is that we can manipulate the size of the tree. Many of us don't want a 20-foot apple tree. Harvesting a tree like that is really difficult. But depending on the kind of rootstock you pick, you can have a tree that only grows to a mature height of maybe 8 feet. And that makes it much easier to maintain.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me today, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Grant Thompson, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. You are welcome to join us with your questions, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Grant Thompson, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and we have been focusing so far on plant propagation, but you can ask questions about any of the plants and trees in your life, although we are going to start with a question about plant propagation. Carol is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a beautiful peace lily, and I wanted to just take it out of the pot, cut through the middle with a big butcher knife, and then repot it. Would that be a good or a bad idea?
Grant?
You know, that may be a little bit of a challenge for your peace lily. I'm not sure how well that would work for that particular one.
All right, but division is a way we can propagate plants, some plants.
Yeah.
Aaron, what do you think?
I think, you know, it'll probably be a little difficult to get through the plant. A knife will help. You could also use a small saw. You can divide it, especially if it's a really large plant, but you'll want to probably not split it into more than probably 3 or 4 pieces at the very most. I'd probably only split it in half. The larger the each of the divisions are, the more likely you'll be successful with it. But probably the best way to propagate peace lily is through division. Just make sure that you're getting 2 healthy pieces when you're done.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Carol. You can send your email questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Bill is on the line now in Duncombe, Iowa. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I wish to know what would be the preferred herbicide and when to apply it on an asparagus patch.
Aaron?
It can be pretty difficult to have a selective herbicide for this method. You can use, with good timing, especially if you're having trouble with grasses, which a lot of us do have trouble with grasses in our asparagus patch. If you can apply a non-selective herbicide, maybe something that has the active ingredient like glyphosate, before the asparagus begins to emerge, this type of herbicide only impacts green growing tissue. So if the grass is green but the asparagus isn't up yet, you can do that. If any of the asparagus is poking through the ground, though, that herbicide will have a negative impact on the asparagus as well. So you have to do the timing, get it before the asparagus pops up, but after the grass greens up or the weeds green up in the spring.
All right, Bill, thanks so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question, an email question from Derek in Cedar Rapids. We're needing to replace some trees after the derecho. We fell in love with the Norfolk Island pine after a vacation in Florida. Is there a pine that looks similar or that can withstand, or a wispy pine that can withstand Iowa winters? Aaron, what do you think?
I think, you know, there isn't anything that looks similar to Norfolk Island pine for us here in Iowa. That's a very tropical plant, really. I think the closest potential to kind of the open branching and large size that Norfolk Island pine gets is the native eastern white pine. And that does very well here in Iowa.
All right. Here's another email question from Suzanne in Iowa City. Because of the derecho, we lost trees in wooded areas and ravines, so there's more sunlight in those places. What can we plant to prevent invasive species? Honeysuckle is one, from quickly filling in. Grass, rye, and when can it be planted? I'm not sure which one of you wants to tackle that one.
I would say a grass like something like what they mentioned could be good. You could plant that just as things starting to warm up here, probably early to mid-April would be a good place to go. I think the approach is a good one. Working to Mother Earth always covers bare soil with plants. And so if you have a say over what those plants are, that can help crowd out maybe what would otherwise move in that might be more invasive, like honeysuckle. It probably isn't going to be a catch-all. You'll likely see an increase in some of these plants, and you'll have to manage them through kind of selective pruning or digging. You could use herbicides selectively as well to kind of keep ahead of it. The most success will come by being proactive about it, and I think this is a great first step.
All right. And it's hard to overstate the amount of invasive species that we see in our woodland areas. Is that going to be a big issue with more sunlight? Is that going to change things? And
yes. Okay. Yes, it will. Absolutely. And there'll be things that you may not recognize as invasive that are actually can be invasive. So some really common landscape plants like burning bush and barberry are really prevalent in our woodland areas. They tolerate shade, but they love more sun. And as soon as that opens up, they become very happy and have the potential of growing. And you look at those and you don't think right off the bat, ooh, weed, because we often grow them in our landscapes.
Right. Wow. Well, that's a fun side effect I hadn't even thought about yet. That's great. Here's a question from Emily in State Center. And since you already mentioned hydrangeas, Grant, I'm going to toss this one to you. Can the little quickfire hydrangea handle a west side? What is their life expectancy and bloom expectancy?
Hydrangeas are going to do kind of best when they have a more moderated exposure. Certainly sunlight is going to help with the flowering, but if you've got a really hot west exposure, that may be a bit stressful for those.
All right. And what do you guys think about life expectancy and bloom expectancy? It's going to be a hard, challenge anyway. So not very good, huh?
Yeah, the more stressful the environment is, the shorter that bloom time is going to last.
Would you recommend something else for that kind of environment on a west side?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think it really depends on what they want. If Emily is looking for something with some flower, you know, quince is a possibility. It may not be the most spectacular plant, but it'll really handle tough conditions.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Carrie is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Great, thank you. So I unsuccessfully tried to propagate some dogwood last summer, but then over the winter, I ended up wintering them in some dirt in the fridge, and I got some sprouts, or seedlings. And so now I've got the seedlings. What do I do now? Do I fertilize them? Do I let them sit? And how long do I wait till I take them outside?
Grant?
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about your seedlings. They've got a couple of seed leaves and maybe a real leaf at this point.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. I've got four of them with two leaves.
Okay. So, you know, at this point, you could maybe move them to a pot, get them out of your fridge, kind of keep them inside. You're not going to want to get them outside until kind of after the real risk of frost has passed. So that will be kind of into early May. You'll want to kind of acclimate them to being outside. Whatever light you're getting inside, even through a window, is going to be not quite as strong as full sunlight. So you'll need to adapt them a little bit. But, you know, mid-May, you should be able to plant them in your landscape.
Great. And any fertilizer at this point?
Not at this point. I would wait a little bit until you get them outside and happy. You know, fertilizing them at this point may get them, you know, potentially pot-bound even in the short period of time that you may be holding them inside, depending on your pot size.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Carrie. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Charlie is up next in West Des Moines. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. I've got a yard. The house was a spec house by one of the builders in town. And they plotted it in, I think it was the middle of November last fall. And we got snow pretty quickly after that. And I'm wondering, when can I start watering it and how much I should water it?
Aaron?
So have you noticed, is the sod rooted in at all, or is it still just sitting on top of the subsoil?
I think it's probably still frozen. Just sitting on top.
Okay. Well, once the grass starts to green up, you can begin kind of regular watering again, because once it starts to green up, it's growing, and it'll green up sooner than a lot of our other garden plants will. Lawns tend to do that for us. The big thing to keep in mind is not to accidentally overwater. Your goal here is to keep that sod from drying out until it can root down into the soil below. And that will probably happen fairly quickly once things start actively growing. I would anticipate a lot of this to begin the first part of April, but it really depends a little bit on the weather. Your goal is to keep that sod, especially the little edges, from drying out. And then once it starts to root in, you can slowly cut back. So if you're watering a couple of times a week to keep that sod from drying out, as it roots in, you can cut back to a week, then every 2 weeks, and then hopefully by middle of May, first part of June, it's established enough where you'll only have to water if conditions get really dry because of the weather.
Okay. So like this last week, I've got a rain gauge out there so I can keep track of how much water it's getting. And we got, I think, an inch of water on it from the rain and everything.
Yeah. Now, the water, about an inch provided by you or Mother Nature. You both can contribute to this.
By Mother Nature, yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
And then also, I've got a roller, you know, one of the plastic rollers that you fill up with water that I used when I was establishing a lawn from seed years ago. Would the sod benefit at all from me running over it with that?
Not likely. Usually the rollers cause more compaction, which makes it harder for the roots to establish.
Okay, great. And then also, I've got some granular pre-emergent to put on there. They told me at one of the garden places after the end of March. Is that good advice? Or
is the pre-emergent primarily for crabgrass?
Yeah.
Your goal here is to apply the pre-emergent when soil temperatures get to 55 degrees. That's typically kind of early to mid-spring. Iowa State University has a great resource online for soil temperatures because a proper application of certain fertilizers in fields depend on soil temperatures too. And so you can kind of get an idea of soil temperatures using that website for your part of the state.
Cool. Great. I'll go check that out. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Charlie. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Grant Thompson, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And Cheryl is on the line next in Pilot Mound. Hi, Cheryl.
Yes, good morning. Hi. My question is, we are siding a garage that's near our home, and it has some daylilies planted on one side of it. Now, they'll have to dig down about 4 feet on that side to, you know, get the bottom layer of siding on. So what's the best thing to do with the daylilies? Will they survive a dig at this time of year? Do I have to put them in the ground immediately or put them in a bucket of water, or what would I do?
Well, daylilies are one of those plants that we can propagate through division, and whether or not you want more of them, you could certainly move them to a pot temporarily or heal them in elsewhere. That could be in a pile of compost or even a pile of mulch and water them in. At this time of year, if they're just starting to poke their heads up, you should be able to locate them and figure out where to move them.
Okay, but so they would either move them into the ground somewhere, did you say, or else put them in compost and mulch?
You could do either. If you put them in pots, you'll just need to make sure you're on top of watering and maybe keep them out of direct sunlight. If they're in a black pot, that can really heat up the root zone pretty quick.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Cheryl. 866-780-9100. We've got another propagation question for you, Grant. This is from Willard in Greenfield. Hi, Willard.
Good morning. My question involves taking a cutting from a lilac bush and starting that. Can you describe that process as opposed to a house plant?
Sure. So with lilac, that is one that is probably going to propagate best from what we would call a softwood cutting. So these are when the lilac just begins to grow and the foliage, the new growth this year is still pretty green and flexible. You could actually test this by giving that soft shoot a little bit of bend. If it snaps, you'll know that it's ready to go. You can take a cutting of that, use some rooting hormone. You want to remove the lower third or the lower half of the leaves on the stem that you take, and then you'll want to make sure that that gets plenty of water and that you control that humidity. Anytime we have fully expanded leaves on a cutting, we really risk those drying out before they get their roots growing.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Willard. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Let's go back to an email question here from Michelle in Cedar Rapids. I have thousands of cleome seeds collected from plants purchased at nurseries last year. Would it be a mistake to sow these in a spot we're establishing as a pollinator-friendly area? Would cleome be considered invasive or aggressive or non-beneficial to pollinators? Aaron, what do you think?
I think cleome would be fine.
Sorry about that.
Yeah,
I knew I was probably wrong.
No, potato, potato. It's fine. This is a plant that does readily self-sow itself in your garden, but it's not as aggressive as a lot of more weedy species in most situations. And so many of us will have Cleome from year to year in our garden because it does drop seed, but it doesn't tend to travel all over the place. Of course, there are probably at least one listener out there who has had that potential happen to them. But for the most part, it is a pretty pretty behaved reseeder. And it is a nice potential for pollinators because of those big open flowers that they have.
All right. So you think she should go ahead?
Yeah, I would give it a try. The good news is that Cleome, when it comes up out of the ground, is a really easy to identify seedling. So if it gets to a point where you don't want to have it anymore, it's really easy to rogue it out in the early season. And one season of removing all of it will remove most of the seed bank and hopefully not have as much issue with it if you're trying to get rid of it, if you change your mind.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens and Ames, and Grant Thompson, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. You can join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
The Iowa legislature is in session.
Let's just go around. We got a lot of people.
There are proposals for constitutional amendments, education, taxes, the budget, and many policy bills.
So what needs to be fixed?
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, is following the session.
I want to thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
I'm John Pemble. Subscribe to the podcast or hear Under the Golden Dome on our website, iowapublicradio.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Grant Thompson, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. You can email your questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's get back to the phones here. Jim is on the line in Hiawatha. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I'm... got a question. I was talking to my local nursery about trees and mulch, and they had mentioned the benefits to biochar as a new product that improves soil and helps stimulate root growth by holding nutrients. And by doing some of my own research, I've found that some gardeners are getting 20 to 30% better yields by using biochar. Do you guys have any information or thoughts? I'm thinking about incorporating into my garden. I guess that's to whoever would like to,
yeah, well,
to answer.
Aaron, I'll let you hit that one first. And I was just looking up biochar. So it's a charcoal that's produced. It's supposed to. I don't actually understand. I can't summarize what I'm reading. So can you explain what it is?
I do know a little bit about biochar. It is a byproduct of processing certain agriculture products. In particular, there has been some biochar that comes from ethanol production, and this is one of the reasons why it's become a bit more. Out there in terms of folks considering it, because it with the ethanol industry in Iowa, it really started to expand as an option. It is certainly something that has a great potential as a kind of a more, I guess I'll use organic approach to this, because it is utilizing a byproduct that, and it is organic in nature. They have done some research on biochar at Iowa State, both in landscape situations and in greenhouse situations. And based on what I know about that research, is it has been relatively good, but it seems to perform like a lot of other organic kind of fertilizers, in that it is kind of a lower level of fertilization, but can help not only provide a little bit of nutrient to plants, but also help a little bit with soil building and soil quality, but there's still a lot to be learned about how this particular product interacts in our landscapes. So there's a little bit out there. It's been positive so far, but there's still a lot more to learn.
Okay. Grant, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, I'd echo everything Aaron said. Biochar is produced by burning your feedstock with it, without the presence of oxygen. And in a lot of ways, you can think about biochar the same way you might think about compost, where it kind of depends on what went in the first place. It depends on how it was treated. And so the end product can actually be quite variable. And a lot of the research right now is trying to figure out, you know, what are those sources of variability. But what Aaron said about it being akin to kind of an organic fertilizer of sorts, it'll help with a little bit of nutrient water retention. If you're on the fence about biochar, certainly compost is going to be another good idea. The one thing with biochar is because it's a very fine particulate charcoal, you may want to wear a mask or other kind of covering, and it can be quite messy to work with. It'll tend to cling to your clothes and get all over the place.
Okay. All right. And it sounds like we'll probably be hearing quite a bit more about biochar in the next few years. So you feel like it's on the cusp of being something that's a lot more common and widely used, Grant?
There's a lot of interest for a number of reasons, including carbon sequestration and soil health building. So it's kind of a hot topic and research area right now. There's a lot to be determined, though.
All right. Well, great question. I certainly learned a few things there. Let's get back to the phones. 866-780-9100. Doug is on the line in Mount Vernon. Hi, Doug.
Hello. We lost many Norwegian spruce around our acreage during the derecho. And we're going to replant some, but is there a grass that can be put down or a ground cover that can be put down now that this space is open? I don't want to mow it.
Aaron?
So you're kind of looking for a no-mow kind of ground
cover?
Yeah,
short no-mow something. Yeah, possible.
Sure. And it's in full sun?
It's pretty open. it's pretty open. It's semi because those 150-year-old trees are gone, you know, and it's kind of sad. But
Yeah. Well, there are certainly a lot of turf grasses that can be used in this situation. And you don't have to mow turf. Most of it will get, it won't grow much taller than 10 or 12 inches, if not mown. And if that's a look that you're okay with, just about any of the cool season grasses could be established in this area with some good success and would likely do well in the kind of light conditions that you have. I think too, the other thing that kind of leans me this direction is most turf grasses, especially a lot of the perennial and if you really want something more short-term, annual ryegrass germinates relatively quickly and can kind of get established quickly. A lot of the other ground covers that we might use in this situation would probably be planted as plants, which increases the cost of investment in it and would take more time to establish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Annual rye, maybe, to get a quick growth, huh?
Yeah. It won't be there next year if you do annual rye, but maybe that's okay in this situation.
All right, Doug. Thanks a lot for your call. And let's go next to Simon in Des Moines. Hi, Simon.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
So I've been losing hickory trees. I lost one about 4 years ago, another one about 2 years ago. The last one that I cut down, when we cut it down, it was full of a white grub. And I've got one left. I'm trying to save it. Is there anything I can do to protect it from whatever's going on?
Grant, you want to take this one?
There can be a number of kind of webworms and caterpillars and stuff that can be a problem. I'm not an expert in this area. I don't know. Aaron?
You know, there are some diseases that can cause some issues in hickory, like verticillium wilt and some of those types of things. And you may be seeing insects in the tree as a secondary issue. So the tree went down or was under stress because of some kind of fungal or bacterial infection. And then the insects moved in because of that stress. It's hard to know which one came first without kind of laying eyes on it. And so I think given that this tree sounds fairly important to you, it would be beneficial to hire an arborist to come out, take a look at this tree, explain the situation that you've had with the other ones, and have them kind of do an analysis on the tree to see what might be going on. You could also potentially fill out some information and submit maybe even some samples to the insect and plant diagnostic clinic. But I think starting with a good reputable arborist to come out and give you a consultation would be worth the fee.
All right, Simon, thanks a lot. Sorry, no easy answers on that one. Let's go next to Jerry in Grinnell. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, I think I have a yes or no question. Is it too late to prune pear and apple and cherry trees?
Aaron?
No, you could do those. Now is a great time.
Great. Good job.
Oh, wonderful.
Nice, easy question, Jerry. Thanks a lot for your call. Okay, next let's go. We've got another propagation question for you, Grant, from Bob in Ames. Hi, Bob.
Yes. I love the old varieties of shrubs, particularly Snowball and Mock Orange. And I've got permission to go on to a property where some of these ancient shrubs are living. What's the best way? Do I dig a root sprout from the edge of the old plant, or is it better to try to propagate a stem?
For the most part, I think stem cuttings are probably going to be your best bet. And the real thing with stem cuttings is it kind of depends on the time of year. We usually have pretty good success with softwood cuttings. So that's kind of early growth, May, June, and July. They tend to root fairly well. Depending on the species, we also have some good success with semi-hardwood. So we take those later in the season, kind of early fall, September, and potentially even hardwood cuttings, which we take in the dormant season, so over winter. So it may take a little bit of homework to figure out which one of those might be best in your case, depending on which ones you want to propagate.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Bob. Good luck with that. And we've got a mock orange question since Bob just mentioned mock orange. Paul is on the line in South English. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. I have a mock orange that's about 9 foot tall. It's always been kind of scraggly and lopsided, particularly has one stem that is larger than any of the others and is kind of taller than the others. How might I prune that and when to help its shape?
Aaron, you want to do this one?
So mock orange does have kind of typically have kind of a multi-stem kind of habit. And so if you have, you know, one kind of older stem that seems to kind of ruin the overall shape, you could prune that out. And I would be inclined to prune it out at the or near the ground level, within a couple of inches of the ground. If that one stem removes more than a third or a half, I would stop there, of the a third or the half of the entire plant, and then see what kind of grows or comes up from the base of the plant after that. If you remove that older stem and you still have more than a third of the plant left, you could remove a couple other stems too. The one thing that you would want to keep in mind is that this is actually a decent time of year to do this, but it will very much impact the flowering of this plant doing it at this time. But it may be worth kind of sacrificing a good flower display for a year or two to get this plant a more manageable size and a more attractive shape or habit.
When should that be done?
You can do this kind of pruning really probably any time now, all the way up through when the first new growth starts here in the spring. But while it's dormant, it's fine.
All right, Paul, thanks a lot for your call. And let's go to Bob in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have about a 15-year-old lilac bush. It's really healthy. There's probably like 15 or 20 shoots, you know, out of the ground. Can I transplant that? And if so, do I split it up or?
Grant, you want to take that?
You could transplant that. Would probably have better success doing it early before it really starts growing. And if you do that, you're going to want to make sure that you water it, you know, kind of carefully to help get the new roots established before that growth gets too vigorous.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot for your call. Here's another propagation question for you, Grant, from Sherry in Marshalltown. I read online that I could just cut the top off a snake plant leaf and put it in water and it would root. I've had one in water for months with no movement at all. I don't want to take one of the side shoots yet as it's been growing nicely in the pot since I transplanted it. My sister would like a piece of this plant. It was our grandmother's and is older than I am, and I'm 67. That's very cool. But what should she do?
Yeah, so snake plant can take a while to produce roots. It can be kind of slow. A good way to propagate this is through division, so if you're able to divide it. But if you're really set on cuttings, maybe you just need to give it a little bit more time.
Really?
And or you could try, instead of doing it in water, doing it in something like a sand or a perlite and watering it frequently.
Okay, and she says she's had it in water for months. Should she start over with a new cutting?
Yeah, she may want to give that a try. I've had mixed success, but when I'm able to do it here, I can do it with a mist bench, and certainly that makes things a bit easier.
All right, and is this something where root stimulator or the root hormone might be a good idea?
It may help some. One note about snake plant, if the original plant is a banded kind where it has a golden band on the outside, propagating it by cutting is going to lose that band. There's a layering effect that has to go on within the cuticle to keep that banded color. Whereas if it's the kind of green and yellow stripes through the middle of the leaf, the kind of spotty color, that'll stay put. If it is that banded type and you want to keep that band, division is the way to go.
Okay. Fascinating. All right. Let's try to slip in a couple more questions here. Aaron, this one's from Lynn in Iowa City. We have a damp, shady area of lawn that was torn up when we had some work done on our house. Moss is growing in the area. Can we reseed the lawn now? And if so, what kind of grass should we use?
Grass will be challenging in a shady situation like this, especially if moss is really happy there. I would be inclined to look at other ground covers, and there are a lot of ground covers that would do well in this situation. Things like Lamium and Pachysandra, Vinca, there are a whole host of kind of shade-loving ground covers that will do much better than turf. You will be challenged to grow turf in a situation where moss is happy.
So avoid the frustration is your advice there.
Yeah.
Here's a question from Mary. My transplanted daffodils have stopped blooming, possibly because I planted them too deeply. Could I move them as soon as they emerge, or do I need to wait until the foliage has died back later in the season?
I would be inclined to see what happens this year. And if you don't see any blooms this year, there's kind of two reasons this happens. Either the clump is too crowded or they're too deep. And deep could have happened because they were planted too deeply, or you put a really thick layer of mulch on top. Both can contribute to it. If you are going to move them, I would pull them out of the ground and replant them in fall.
All right, we are out of time. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the questions today, but we will be back again next Friday. Aaron Stile, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Grant Thompson, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Come back again soon. Grant Thompson, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.
I'm Ben Kiefer. Each day on River to River, we focus on the news, issues, and events that shape our state. We aim to go beyond the headlines, giving listeners access to state legislators, congressmen, and policymakers, and allowing you to discuss the issues and offer ideas and solve problems as well. Join us on River to River, weekdays at noon on Iowa Public Radio.
Bye.